on this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we welcome a phenom starting pitcher to the major leagues. Jacob Mizorowski is throwing 102, and you might not even know what team he plays for. We talk about five players that we are worried about off the slow starts, and it's the good, the bad, and the ugly. But no Jordan Schusterman this week. Maybe he demanded a trade. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that would never demand a trade. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Russ Dorsey, Jordan Schuster.
I might demand a trade. I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why? Are you not happy?
Oh, no, I'm happy, but sometimes you just got to show people that you can do it.
Love that. Yes, power moves only. Yeah. I'll do it if you make me. On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we're going to talk about the news rocking the baseball world. Aaron Civale of the Milwaukee Brewers picks up his fist, slams it on the table, and says, trade me, MF-er. Obviously, it's not the biggest deal when the five-starter on the Brewers does anything, but it is compelling because we don't see a lot of trade demands in this business. We're also going to talk about Jacob Mizorowski's electrifying debut. One of the top pitching prospects in baseball showed up in Milwaukee last night. Russ is going to walk me through five players that he's concerned about. I wonder if one of them is me. I'm concerned about myself. And then we'll do the good, the bad, the ugly, talk a little bit about the weekend ahead and say goodbye. But let's begin with our opener. Our opener on this episode is Jacob Mizorowski. So he was committed to transfer to LSU from a junior college. And that's kind of like, that's what makes him super interesting to me is like, he, first of all, he's 6'7" and he looks like a combination of Chris Sale, but even somehow slimmer. He goes to a junior college in Missouri, carves, is going to transfer to LSU and like be on the staff with Skeens. But instead, the Brewers draft him and give him so much money that he has to sign, right? And, like, the thing with him that I think everyone should know is he throws 100. Like, I know we now live in a day and age where everyone throws 100, but this 100 comes out pretty hot.
One of the things, slim Chris Sale is insane. Like, when you say that, like, that hit me in the face of, like, all right, Chris Sale is one of the slimmest human beings I've ever seen. And then a slim Chris Sale on the mound throwing 100 is wild. But I think one of the cool things to me about Mizorowski and the Brewers having a type of talent like that is you look at all the guys they've had over the years, right? You're talking about Corbin Burns, Brandon Woodruff at his best, Freddie Peralta. No more Burns. Woodruff is getting a little bit longer in the tooth. Freddie Peralta is probably gone after next season. And you look at the Brewers and how they've been able to sustain as a team that does not really spend and has to develop ace after ace after ace because they're not going to go and acquire that guy. And so you have this guy, Mizorowski, now because Aaron Ashby was supposed to be that next up, hasn't really worked that way for him. And now you have a uber talented guy for Chris Hook and the pitching infrastructure in Milwaukee to say, okay, we have one of those guys. Can we mold him into being the next great young starter in the National League? Because they've proven over the years that they can build and develop not only one, but multiple of those guys in the same rotation. So I'm excited to see what they're able to do with him.
If he had been on any other team, not any other team, but a number of other teams, it would have been a much, much bigger deal here. Mizorowski's prospect status is very interesting because, like I said, he doesn't play high-level college baseball, and so we don't have clips of him in the SEC or in Omaha sitting people down with 100. He's drafted by the Brewers in the second round, and so he's not a first-round pick, even though he gets a bonus that's commensurate with a first round selection. So he gets $2.35 million in a slot that's usually $1.1 million. And as he's coming up the chain, he's sitting in like, for the rankings, anywhere between like 25 and 75. He's never really in that upper echelon, but that's just because of the risk associated with this type of pitcher, right? He's skinnier, Slim Chris Sale. He, I would say, because his limbs are flailing all about, he still doesn't have great control of his body. And that just means that his command and his control is a step behind. And he doesn't really have a weapon against left-handed hitters, which gives him a lot of reliever risk compared to most pitchers that are in the top 100. But that doesn't mean the ceiling isn't there, right? And so I would say this guy's ceiling, if it clicks and he's able to stay in the rotation, is that of a top five prospect in baseball. If you said Jacob Mizorowski, you're guaranteed he's going to like throw enough strikes to be in the rotation, it's a top five prospect in baseball. And the ceiling being so nuts means that when it all shows up in a debut, like it did last night against the Cardinals, it makes you sit and stare and watch. So he threw five innings last night, four walks, no hits, five Ks. He was throwing 100 miles an hour with the heater. I think he averaged 99.1, but he had like 14 pitches over 100. But the craziest thing, the slider is at 94. Like, it just sits 94. It looks like a cutter, but because he's got this low slot, it has sweep at 94. And then he has this curveball that he throws at 87, 88 with tons of snap from that low slot. Now, I don't know how the heck he's ever going to get lefties out, because he's more of a supinator than a pronator. His wrist more moves towards a left-handed batter rather than away. So it's hard for him to get that action on the changeup. But I mean, if he could just be this, like, this is whew.
You talk about the slider at 94, and it reminds you of old school Syndergaard, right? Where when he first came up, it was Hundo with that nasty slider where you're like, well, there's some guys that don't have a fastball that is 93, 94, and you're throwing slide balls at 94. That's crazy. And I think the other part is the Brewers, where they are right now, they have the runway to just let him say, go. Like, mess up in the big leagues, make mistakes, throw gas, get guys out, and we'll tinker as we go. Where they're not the best team in the National League Central. They're probably where they are right now, the third best team in the NL Central. They're going to have a rotation spot available here very, pretty soon, since one of the guys doesn't want to be on your team anymore. And I think you can afford to let him learn at the big league level right now. Whereas if they were in a pennant chase and it's like, we really love this kid, but we don't know if he's stick at the big league level right now, but we like the stuff. Like, this is the perfect situation for him, where he can come in, he could dominate. There are going to be some starts where he might get his head kicked in. He might walk the yard. Like, that's okay. And I think for the Brewers, they realize that, which is probably why they're making this move right now.
All right, let's talk about the Aaron Civale piece of this. Because Mizorowski getting called up, that's a rotation spot. And the Brewers, even though they can't hit at all, these guys can pitch it. They're getting outs. And the rotation is pretty stacked right now. Freddie Peralta's got a 269. Jose Quintana, the eternal Brewer, who was never on the Brewers and is now on the Brewers, 266. Quinn Priester, who they acquired about a month and a half ago, he's been great with a 365. Chad Patrick has a 325, and he's going to get Rookie of the Year votes. And so Civale was kind of the obvious guy to go. He is a 491. Now, he's been better than that recently. He had an injury that he was pitching through in the beginning of the season. But Aaron Civale is like your established, totally fine, back of the rotation, relative soft tosser with a deep pitch mix. He's going to give you five with three earned. Like, that's his deal. You don't want him starting in a playoff game. When we get the news that Mizorowski's up and Civale is out of the rotation to the bullpen, we get a trade demand. Now, I went and did some research as far as trade demands go. Nolan Arenado gave like a half demand over the winter that never actually actualized into anything. We have Giancarlo leaving Miami to go to the Yankees. And then Zach Greinke was one I didn't remember, where he was super blunt and just went to the Royals and said, I don't want to be on a rebuilding team. Please trade me. They sent him to Milwaukee. Russ, what are the dynamics behind a trade demand? Like, how does something like this make its way from player to team? And how does it make its way from like player team to the public?
So One of the things when you hear this, you know, when Ken and Will Salmon report this, it's like, whoa, okay, that's wild that this got out. Because one of the things that I always think about is this happens, but in baseball, unlike the other sports where it's like, get me the hell out of here, it's you don't hear about it often. Like, I've heard about players and agents working to get the player moved. That happens a lot, but it rarely ever comes out. You mentioned some of the big boys that have asked for trades over time. And every once in a while, you'll hear a guy allude to it, but they'll never actually say, I want to be traded. Like, you'll, to the Greinke point, it's, I don't want to be on a, I want to be on a winning team. Guys say that all the time. Like, I want to be on a winning team. I don't want to be a part of a long rebuild. That's essentially a guy saying, hey, I need to be moved if this is the direction that we're going in. I think how it works, you usually have a conversation between player and org, right? Where it's just like, hey, and let's in this example use established veteran quality player and team entering or in rebuild mode. Player goes to org and say, hey, man, I love being here. I love this organization. But if this is the direction we're going in, I don't know if I'm want to be here for that. And then org usually says, hey, understandable. Let's try to work through some things. And then if we get the right offer, we're going to do everything we can to like get you in a winning situation. Like, that happens a lot. It's just not spoken about. And then team and agent usually talk like, hey, this is where we're at as a club. We're going to do our best to put your guy in a position to go win a championship, play for a contender, be on somebody's postseason roster, right? And then at usually the deadline, that guy gets moved. Even like your average veteran, a lot of times, you know those trades that you see at the end of the deadline, like the last 5 minutes or 5 to 10 minutes after, like last year, let's say Paul DeJong going to the Royals, moves like that where it's like, hey, we're going to take a flyer on a guy that's an established veteran, hit against left-handers, left-handed pitcher, arm, whatever. Like, those guys usually get moved from a team like the White Sox, who were in a deep rebuild, to a team like the Royals that were going to the postseason. So that's usually how it works, but it never usually comes out where it's like, I demand to be out of here. Like, it's a lot more cordial and polite than what this one came off.
This one is super interesting too, because it's not like Savali is being petulant or childish or juvenile. He is a impending free agent who sees himself as a starting pitcher in the major leagues. His track record proves that he is a back-end starting pitcher in the major leagues. He wants to hit the market this winter and pay, be able to send his grandkids to whatever private school they want, right? And he's never gotten the big bag before, and he's trying to do everything he can to secure that. And I understand that, and I get that, and I respect that, right? I also believe that he has not been there that long. Remember, he was traded there, I think, last trade deadline from the Rays. And so it's not as if like he's in the mix in the trenches with this group. That dynamic of like, oh, is he a bad teammate in this context? I think the players in the room understand what's going on here, that he sees himself as a certain type of player. The dynamic on the Brewers right now does not allow him to be that type of player because they have better starting pitchers. And so he's asking out. Now, I'm curious, what do you see the differences are between this and what's going on or what happened in spring training with Marcus Stroman in the Yankees, where there was not an obvious spot for Stroman in the rotation? He said, I'm a starter. Everyone was like, okay, well, you're the sixth best one. And then everyone got hurt and he ended up being in the rotation. What are the differences between these two situations here?
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that was exactly the example that I was going to use. Because in a situation like the Yankees had, you clearly have a guy that was saying, if I'm not going to be in this rotation, we're going to have to figure something out here, because I've been a starter my entire life in the big leagues, minus a couple of times last year when I wasn't really good, and I want to be a starter the rest of my career. Now, in spring training, And you know this because you've covered ball for a long time. I know this because I covered ball for a long time. Dudes are going to get hurt. That is a guarantee in Major League Baseball. And what happened in spring training for the Yankees? Gerrit Cole needs Tommy John surgery. Boom. Marcus Stroman, come on down. I think the difference here for Savali is, one, he hasn't been great. Two, you have better options if you're the Brewers in a situation where if I'm going to go Aaron Savali, ERA at almost 5, or young stud throwing 100 with a 94-mile-an-hour slider that we want to give like, opportunities to start and get outs in the big leagues, I'm going with the kid 10 times out of 10, right? And I think for Savali, yes, it's better for him and his career to just have a team take a flyer on him, get traded, and then, hey, there's teams looking for pitching depth every day, right? So this is probably going to end in him getting moved to somebody that has some injuries, needs an arm, and then, you know, he can go there and pitch. And it might end up he pitches in the bullpen anyway. But I think for him, getting as many opportunities to start in the big leagues before you hit free agency is extremely important to him so that he can at least going into the winter say, hey, I have a track record of being a mid-4 ERA guy, give you 5-6 innings of quality-ish baseball, and get yourself a job.
All right, that's enough of the Milwaukee Brewers. Let's take a quick break. And when we get back, Russell Dorsey is going to hold my hand and tell me that everything about every baseball player always is going to be okay. And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. We just talked about Aaron Savali for 10 minutes, and then literally during the break, he got traded. Savali going to the Chicago White Sox in exchange for first baseman Andrew Vaughn.
See, that means we know what we're talking about.
Oh, that's
we so called good. It team that needs starting pitching depth acquires Aaron Savali. Like it's almost like we did this on purpose. But look, you have a situation, a team like the Chicago White Sox, rebuilding team that needs innings, that can afford to have a guy like Aaron Savali in their rotation and give him starts. And then you have Andrew Vaughn going to Milwaukee in return. This via Jesse Rogers. Andrew Vaughn, his time was over in Chicago. And really quickly, a disappointing tenure for Andrew Vaughn in Chicago for the Chicago White Sox. You're talking about a guy that was drafted 3rd overall in the, and this is tough, the Adley Rutschman Bobby Witt Jr. draft. And you look at that and say, when he was drafted, there were people that said he was the most pro-ready bat in the draft. I believe he was the first of those players in that draft to get to the big leagues. And it just never clicked. And it's one of the things where you look at, we talk about the disappointing window, or the window that wasn't for the Chicago White Sox. He's a part of that, right? Like that was supposed to be a guy that was 280 to 300 with 25 to 30 pumps. And you never got that from Andrew Vaughn. So end of that tenure for the White Sox, for Andrew Vaughn. And they do this thing in Milwaukee where they grab former top prospect first baseman, and then they go to Milwaukee, rake, and then they're just forever in that 700 to 800 OPS range.
I want to hop in on Vaughn for a second. So, I mean, this is a historically stacked draft in retrospect. Rutschman, Witt, Andrew Vaughn, JJ Bladé, who is not great, but he's a better player than Andrew Vaughn. Riley Green, banger. CJ Abrams, stud. Nick Lodolo, if he could stay healthy, underrated. Josh Young, bangs. Shane Langeliers, everyday catcher. Hunter Bishop at 10 to the Giants is not great. But Corbin Carroll, George Kirby are in there. You get Gunner in the second round. This is a great draft. And I think what happened with Vaughn is a reminder why drafting a first baseman that high has so much risk attached to it. Because if the bat doesn't cook, he's not a viable big leaguer. Whereas if Andrew Vaughn's offensive profile was attached to a league average defensive third baseman or a good shortstop. He's like an at least an everyday player. And so when you draft a first baseman that high, you're just banking on the bat. And if sometimes that turns into, you know, Freddie Freeman or what Spencer Torkelson is doing now or Adrian Gonzalez first overall, there are examples of it hitting. But there, this is what the downside looks like. I don't understand this trade at first glance. I think it's a little – here's a couple things. Andrew Vaughn does not have an obvious path to playing time with the Brewers right now. They have Yelich DHing most of the time because he stinks defensively and his body's broken. They have Rhys Hoskins at first base. They have Jake Bowers like in left field platooning with Daz Cameron sometimes. Garrett Mitchell is on the aisle, Blake Perkins on the aisle, a couple of other guys in that mix. But there's no first base DH at-bats here for Vaughn, and he's not a great corner outfielder. So I would imagine this is either a bench bat or they'll just stash him at AAA, and if someone gets hurt, they'll bring him up. As far as the White Sox side goes, correct me if I'm wrong here, Russ, but like this feels like they're acquiring Savali to give him 7 starts and then trade him in a month and a half.
1,000%. Like they're in the acquire and trade part of their rebuild right now. And well, that's actually not a bad place to be. Andrew Vaughn was in AAA. He didn't have a, you know, normal playing time in the big leagues anymore. So you go to Milwaukee now, and I agree with you. There is going to be some type of platoon split here. Like, I don't imagine he's going to get everyday ABs. But even if he's a bench bat or they try him at a different position, it's not the worst, you know, project if you're the Milwaukee Brewers. Like, I think they turned Jake Bowers into a serviceable big leaguer, you know, finding him the right matchup, platoon splits, et cetera. So can you do that with Andrew Vaughn in a very hitter-friendly environment? I think they can. I think they have the ability to do that. I 100% agree with you on your Vaughn assessment, and it's why Spencer Torkelson was in the danger zone coming into this year. Because and I've talked to, you know, you've probably talked to baseball people about this. I talked to a lot of people, you know, in Detroit about this. Like, the bat had to play for Tork. Like, it had to play. And for Andrew Vaughn, same thing. Because you don't do anything else at an above average level, your bat has to be great. If your bat isn't great, this pick was not worth it.
So listen, White Sox fans, don't buy your Savali jersey now. He's probably not going to be there for the long haul.
Hey, Dad, if you're listening.
We're walking around the South Side.
He's like, hey, man, I'm going to get a text before this podcast is over. With Aaron Savali. That's a nasty jersey to be walking around Chicago with. The Aaron Savali 7 start jersey.
Woof. We talked about this recently when Drewski was wearing the White Sox Mike Soroka jersey on some stream. And it's like, where did you get that?
You talk about a guy that you don't remember. Give me White Sox I don't remember for 500, Alex. I mean, Mike Soroka. Yikes.
So yeah. Listen, Pope, don't buy your Savali jersey just yet. All right, Russ, let's take a pivot and let's have a couple nuclear overreactions. You wrote something this week, 5 players that you're concerned about.
Yeah.
We've reached the point in the season, it's June 13th, all right? Summer is in full swing and some players are not in full swing. Yes, sir. Or maybe they're doing too many full swings. Nailed it. Who are some guys that you are worried about?
Let's stick on the South Side for a second. Let's go to center field in Chicago, where we find Luis Robert Jr., who used to be known as Cuban Mike Trout. And you look at Luis Robert Jr., a couple years ago, he finished 12th in AL MVP voting, was an all-star silver slugger, Gold Glove Award winner. Like, you're talking about one of the best center fielders in all of Major League Baseball. I think you could have made a case back then that he was the best top 3 center fielders in baseball. And that seems like that was a long time ago, because you watch Luis Robert Jr. right now Let me read off some numbers to you, Jake Mintz. Slash line for Luis Robert Jr. this year. In 61 games, 185, 269, 303 with a 31% strikeout rate. Over the last 30 games, Jake Mintz, how many home runs does Luis Robert Jr. have? This is a guy that hit 38 2 years ago.
I'm going to go with zero, Russell Dorsey.
The answer, Jake Mintz, is one home run that he hit 2 days ago. Without that homer, we're talking about a month and a half since his last home run. Like, the power has disappeared. And we're at a point in the year where I don't see that getting better. The at-bats look atrocious. There is no plan at the plate. Like, he's going up there and hoping he hits something. Now, ironically, leads the big leagues in stolen bases. So it's like that. That 26% of the time when he's on base, he's going. But outside of that, like, you're not getting anything this year. And this is one of the things I've reported on and reported on it last year. Like, there weren't a ton of calls for Luis Robert Jr. at last year's deadline. Like, teams checked in and called the White Sox, but there were not as much. There wasn't as much conversation or calls around him as things out there would lead you to believe. Like, I know that for a fact. And if he's going to play like this, that phone in Chicago for Chris Getz is going to be very quiet. So I'm very concerned about Luis Robert.
I'm curious about him and his status at the deadline. So I believe he's got a $20 million team option for next year. And I
two more doubt after this year. Yeah.
Two more after this year. If they don't pick that up,
yeah,
he could be a free agent this year. So you would imagine that the White Sox would want to trade him for anything at this point, right? Or else you're going to let him walk and not pick up that option. Are they going to pay $20 million to have this version of Luis Robert around next year just to hope he gets better? Maybe. I think he does have a little bit of value just because he can go get it in center and he steals bases. And maybe you get him out of that environment and he runs into a couple in a playoff series. There aren't that many center fielders like this. I think maybe Cedric Mullins being on the block this deadline season hurts their ability to trade Robert because there is another better option out there. Do you think he gets dealt if you had to predict right now?
All right, so two things. I wrote about that part you started out with. Because he has the two options after this season, if you're the White Sox, you don't have to panic and say, we're going to take pennies on the dollar for him, right? Like, you can essentially pick up the option and hope he has a bounce back next year and will be in the same situation if he doesn't hit. Or he does hit and plays his Gold Glove caliber center field, and then you have the best position player available at next year's deadline, right? Like, in today's baseball money, $20 million is not crazy for what looked like a premier center fielder. He's not that right now. I do think, to your point about the value, I probably disagree, because if I'm looking for a good center fielder, like, just a guy that can go get it, I can find a guy that can go get it and not have to pay $20 million a year for it. Like, if I'm looking for Ender Inciarte, I can go get Ender Inciarte or this year's version of Ender Inciarte.
Yeah, but you could just trade him for this deadline.
To your point about do they trade him, I don't, like, I hear your point. But, like, why? Like, I think you're better off gambling on him bouncing back next year than trading him for nothing this year, because you'll have the same amount of value, right? Like, the value isn't going to get worse than it is right now, and you'll still have the last option on the back end.
I just don't know if Jerry Reinsdorf is going to want to make this $20 million gamble, right? I think there are two reasonable paths forward here. One is that you trade him at this deadline. If you are not planning to pick that option up, if you're going to let him walk, you have to trade him at this deadline. And I do think there is a chance internally the White Sox are like, you know what? This is never going to get fixed. Let's just cut bait here. Let's trade him at the deadline. Hopefully we can get something. We'll use the threat of picking up the option as leverage. Or you pick up the option, you give him the 20 mil, and you try again next year. Though, if you're going to let him walk, you cannot hold on to him at this deadline. You cannot just do that. Because to me, that is just a complete missed opportunity. All right, enough about Luis Robert. Give me another guy on your list.
All right, other guy on my list. I've written about this guy this year already, Willy Adames, who signed a monster deal to go play out in San Francisco with the San Francisco Giants. If you look at the numbers since 2000, it's the toughest ballpark to hit in Major League Baseball. And even tougher for right-handed hitters. You're talking about a guy on Willy Adames that had a career-high 32 home runs last year, had really figured out who he was as a hitter, big-time power. There were some swing and miss in this game, but like overall, you're looking at a guy, very solid shortstop, big-time power, run producer. That has not happened. And it's one of those things like you could have kind of predicted, but numbers for Willy Adames, 203, 288, 339 in 67 games. He currently has 7 home runs, Jake Mintz, and that includes 2 in Colorado this week. So essentially, we're talking about 5 home runs this season for Willy Adames. And I'm concerned for Willy because I think Willy Adames is a fantastic baseball player. And I wrote about him a lot during the offseason. And there are some front offices that thought he was the best position player available outside of Juan Soto. And I still think that's true. The problem is fit is very important when we're talking about free agents. And I liked Buster Posey acquiring Willy Adames from the standpoint of guy in the room, guy who has a winning attitude for what you wanted to build. And look, the Giants are playing good baseball in a division where we thought they would, you know, drift into the distance. But if Willy Adames isn't going to be an 850 OPS guy for you, that like it does, the whole thing does not work.
And they have him for a long
Hence
time.
I'm concerned.
If you want to look at why.
Yeah, there's 6 more years on this deal. Yeah.
If you want to look at why it's kind of tailed off this year, StatCast has a good metric called launch angle sweet spot, which I know is like a lot of words. But the idea is how often are you hitting the baseball at the optimal angle? Not beating it into the ground, not popping it up into the air. I believe it's between like 10 and 30 degrees. And he has the 6th biggest drop in that year over year compared to last year. So he is hitting the ball a little bit softer on average, but it's mostly about the way he's striking the baseball, at the angle he's striking it. He's not driving it into the gaps as much. He's probably beating it into the ground or popping it up. I have enough faith in Willy Adames, the player, to get it figured out. I think he's athletic enough where he might need to like change his approach and maybe trade a little bit of juice for contact in that park. And I think he's capable of doing that to an extent. Now, the glove is going to keep this contract from being a catastrophe. Similar to the way that Dansby Swanson in Chicago hasn't quite gotten back to that offensive ceiling he showed his last year in Atlanta, where he took that walk year into a big deal. Adames, similar situation. The only difference is everyone else around Dansby Swanson is raking, whereas the Giants don't have that same kind of lineup. They're depending more on Adames. Who's next on your list?
All right, we're going to go to Cincinnati, where we find this guy was one of my favorite players to watch 2 years ago, Matt McClain. You're talking about a guy in 2023 when people are like, what is the Cincinnati Reds thing? I like that. Who are these young athletic players? When they had Ellie first come up, Spencer Steer, and Matt McClain. And Matt McClain was the best player on that team. And it wasn't even close. Guy that hit over 270, had 17 homers, stole bases, played a plus at that time shortstop and second base. And this year, it just has not clicked for Matt McClain. Hitting 184, he is the 3rd worst qualified hitter in Major League Baseball. Also a guy that is striking out 30.3% of the time. Jake, there's a lot of guys that strike out in the big leagues. Striking out can get you to the Hall of Fame, but the numbers can't be 184 with 30% and very little power. Like, if you're striking out 30% of the time, I'm going to need 35 to 40 homers. And they just haven't gotten that. And I it's one of those situations similar to Adames where, like, if he's not good, it doesn't work. Like, Ellie being the only guy offensively that teams are scared of, the Reds can't be or get to where they want to get to. I still think that athletically, what he showed me offensively 2 years ago, what he can do defensively, like, I still believe in all of those characteristics. Like, I think Matt McClain is a really good baseball player. I really do. But what he's shown so far he's the third worst hitter in Major League Baseball. And it's one of those things where a 30% strikeout rate for a guy that's not giving you any power, like, you're almost unplayable at that point.
I remember when Jordan, who's usually on the pod with me, you know, him, like, taller guy, kind of looks like a Jewish Jacob Mizorowski.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
With Jordan,
I've heard of him.
Jordan was in Cincinnati. Like, he would always be like, yeah, like, once they get Matt McClain off the IL, like, oh, yeah, you know, McClain's hurt. Like, once McClain comes back, McClain was kind of a big piece of that operation. And now he's back and he's playing and it just doesn't look the same. And you're right. The Reds need this guy to figure it out if they're going to reach the heights that they want to get to.
This guy might be the biggest name on this list in that he was supposed to be the best trade candidate at this year's trade deadline. That's Sandy Alcantara. And I look at Sandy, who 2 years ago, Cy Young winner, dominant, took the ball every fifth day, gave you 7, 8, sometimes 9 innings, could strike out 12, but would much rather just pitch deep into games and strike out 6 or 7. And this year, he's just not been the same guy, even though you look at the fastball and you say, oh, still touching 100. That should be the same dominant Sandy, yet it hasn't been. And I think the big thing when I look at Sandy, the fastball is getting hit for nearly 600 slug this year, which is almost 100 points higher than it was in his last full or semi-full season before he had to go down for Tommy John surgery in 2023. And I look at a guy in Sandy Alcantara and I ask the question, similar to the one you asked for Robert, but much different because I think this is a better player. Does a team look at Sandy and say, all right, this guy was the best pitcher on planet Earth in 2022. That guy is still in there. You still have club control on the back end of this. Do you take the gamble and say, all right, we're going to acquire this guy knowing that we could have the best pitcher in baseball on our hands if he figures things out? And is this a situation where a guy playing for a bad club, you know, that's kind of worn on him because he's been there this whole time? I look at Sandy and I say,
I don't think it's that.
This is just one of the things you think about. Like, is it that? Like, there are a lot of things for me where I look at it and I say, man, that guy was too good for too long to be a bum all of a sudden. And over his last 2 starts, 2 quality outings. Now, before we do the whole Sandy's back thing, like I've seen out there, those starts were against the Pirates and the Rockies. So I want to see him do it against other teams, teams above 500, teams that have real threats in their lineup before I can say that. But I think there are teams that are having real conversations about who Sandy Alcantara is at this point.
I'd go get him right now. We're seeing this with Spencer Strider, where sometimes after you get Tommy John, it takes longer to return to the player you used to be. And Sandy is not back up to speed yet, and that's okay, and that's understandable. Remember, he got Tommy John right around the same time that Ohtani did.
Yeah.
And Ohtani hasn't even come back yet. Now, I know that's a different situation, but he's still not that far removed. To me, the biggest difference in the profile is the lack of chase. So even in, remember, 2022 was his amazing season. 2023, when the Marlins made the playoffs, like, he's pitching through a couple things. He's not like his totally good self. He, down the stretch, I think he is throwing through the injury he ends up getting surgery for. But that season, he's getting a 34.8% chase rate. That's 97th percentile in baseball. That means guys are swinging at his stuff outside the strike zone. Right now, that number is down 10% to 24.7% chase rate. That's 17th percentile in baseball. To me, that's like a big part of it. Guys are not expanding the zone against Sandy. And for him to get outs, the way he gets chase is not chase whiff. It's more chase bad contact, right? Like it's getting guys to roll over on a sinker that's a ball down off the zone. And he's just not getting that same type of response. I think it'll get back there. I think it's command. I think once his body is up to speed, he's going to be okay. Now, the question as far as the trade deadline goes, so he has two more years after this one. And is it worth it for the Marlins to deal this version of Sandy with 2.5 years? So it's three playoffs. Or is it worth it to deal an improved version of waited out, deal potentially an improved version of Sandy that's only 2 years or 1.5 years down the road? That's a very interesting conversation. And it will depend on the type of packages they get, right? Their minds can be changed depending on what a competing team offers them up in prospects. So there's a lot of dynamics involved with Sandy. I think it's fascinating. Do I think he's back because he gave the Pirates and Rockies a swirly? No. Do I think in the end he's going to be okay? Yes. Does that happen before this deadline? That's the big question at play. All right, Russ, one more guy and then we'll take a break.
Last guy on this list for me who probably had the most to lose this year of any guy on this list, and that's Zach Gallen of the Arizona Diamondbacks. Zach Gallen this year has just not looked like himself from the outset of the season. And for the last 6 years since he got to Arizona, you're talking about a guy that was routinely pitching between the mid twos and the mid threes, taking the ball every fifth day, giving you quality outings. And him and Merrill Kelly were maybe the best tandem that people didn't talk about in Major League Baseball outside of ball knowers. And this year, you look at a guy, the walks are up, the strikeouts are down. And for a guy, and this is why I say he had the most to lose, who is a free agent at the end of this season, and you looked at it and said, all right, if he has a average Zach Gallen season, you're talking about a guy that was going to get a lot of money this offseason. And now you look at it and say, what do the D-backs do at this year's deadline, right? You lose Corbin Burnes for the year. You're in the toughest division in baseball where you have the Dodgers, Padres, and Giants ahead of you. You're a good team, but not a great team. You'd probably be better in other divisions, but you got to play in the division that you're playing. If you're the D-backs and you're looking at Zach Gallen, we've talked about a lot of pitchers here today. Do you move him at the deadline simply because you're likely not going to bring him back next year? Or does the Burnes injury make you look at it differently and say, all right, Zach, you didn't have your best year, but we're going to bring you back on a 1-2 year deal with an option. You can re-up your value and then you move him next year. Or do you say, Zach, we loved having you here. You're a stud and you move him at this year's deadline?
I think I'd give him the qualifying offer, and I think he might take that.
Yeah,
I think that's the way this is going to play out, right? The QO is, what, 21.5 mil? He's not getting, this version of Zach Gallen's not getting that on the open market right now because it's been a steady decline over the last handful of years on as far as the under-the-hood numbers are concerned and the way that the pitches have been playing and the overall command. Like, when he was at his best, I mean, he was pinpoint on the edges. He could throw all 4 or 5 of his pitches wherever he wanted. He doesn't have that anymore. At least he doesn't have that right now. I think it would be in Gallen's best interest to take that qualifying offer. And I think it would be in the Diamondbacks' best interest to offer it to him because they're not going to have Corbin Burnes for next season. So they need to find pitching any way they can get it. As far as it goes at the deadline this year with them, it's like they got to pick a lane because if they stand pat and they don't trade Gallen or Kelly or Naylor, it's like, oh man, that's a lot of pieces that you kind of wasted and let walk because are probably not going to give Naylor the QO. Would you give Naylor the QO? Maybe you're not giving Kelly the QO. So it's like they're in a very interesting spot as a team and how they play. And so they're just in a very odd spot. Gallen, I am a little worried about. I've said this many times in the pod. I just didn't understand why people were so high in the Diamondbacks rotation. coming into the year. I know that this is before Burns went down, but Gallen just, he hasn't looked like Zach Gallen in a long time. And now it's just gotten really, really bad. Well, Russ, thank you so much for getting us all in a bad mood and worrying about these players that are good. Maybe some of them will turn it around. Who of these players do you think like is the likeliest to get it figured out?
That's a great question. From everything I've seen, I actually think it's Sandy. I think of those five guys, the player Sandy, I'm most easily confident that they will return to being their premier self is Sandy Alcantara, because I know that that guy is one of the best starting pitchers in baseball. And like the stuff is still good. It might not, to your point, might not be as sharp as it was when he was the best pitcher in the world 3 years ago, but there is more than enough stuff that I see in the underlying numbers and the standard numbers to say, okay, you get him in a situation where he doesn't have to pitch 7-8 innings every fifth day for this team to have a chance. You tinker with some things and get him right. I think Sandy is back to being Sandy sooner rather than later.
All right, let's take a break. And when we get back, Russ is going to do the good, the bad, and the ugly. That'll be fun. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It's time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. One thing good, one thing bad, one thing ugly, bizarre, wonky, odd from the week that was. I'm going to go first because the Pope threw on the Sox hat when we found out that our Pope was a Chicago guy and that he was a White Sox fan. It was only a matter of time before he threw the black hat with the White Sox on his head. I knew it was coming. I said it multiple times in this pod. And this week we finally got the picture we were waiting for. It seems that Pope Leo threw this hat on because it was given to him by a couple that was at the Vatican getting married and handed him the hat. Now, what I thought was most interesting about this, Russ, is the type of lid he threw on. This was not a 5950, your typical fitted hat. This was not your, you know, what I would say your old white guy dad hat in the back of your car that's like smushed and sat on. This crown had some real shape to it. This was a good look. It seems to be the 47 brand version, but it stayed well. And this couple was on a 17-day honeymoon in Rome. Good job keeping the hat in good shape.
No, I love this. It definitely looks like the Pope is a ball knower, which from everything we heard, the pictures we've seen of him at the 05 World Series, he's definitely a ball knower. This has been big for, as a Chicago resident and native, this has been big for the people of Chicago that Pope Leo is not only a baseball guy, but a Chicago White Sox guy of all the teams he could have, you know, been a fan of. He's a South Burbs kid like me, so grew up just south of the city. And I was at my parents' house yesterday and we were talking about this. I actually told them, because they didn't know, there's a mural of the Pope right behind the seats that he was sitting at Wrigley Field in Chicago now. Like, the White Sox have gone full send on letting everybody in the world know who the Pope cheers for. They haven't had a lot of things to get excited about there on 35th and Shields. I'm excited that they're excited about the Pope.
Dude, the way he wears the hat is, you're so right. Like, it is a ball knower type hat wearing situation. Like, you don't want to judge books by its cover. You know, the Pope would tell me not to do that. But if you're at a ball game, you can sometimes tell how much ball knowing the person will have by how they wear various types of baseball paraphernalia. And just glancing at the Pope and the way he's moving with the lid, he's a ball knower. Russ, what's good for you this week?
It's Christian Moore, top prospect for the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, getting promoted to the big leagues. Is likely going to make his debut this weekend. And the aggressive Angels strike again, man. Like, this is a team that have been uber aggressive, where it's, whether it's Nolan Schanuel or Zach Neto, now Christian Moore, Ben Joyce, like, they are saying, hey, are you a good college baseball player? Well, come on down. Like, I reported last year and the year before, like, the Angels actively, when they are scouting players before the draft, had been asking the top college prospects, hey, could you play in the big leagues this year? Like, that was a question that they had asked players word for word over the last couple of years. And obviously, as a top prospect in the draft, you're not going to say, oh, you know, 2 years from now, I think my ETA of 2028, it's like, yeah, I think I could play in the big league right now. But they're serious about it. Like, this isn't a team blowing smoke up these guys' butts. Like, they're saying, hey, if you're talented enough and you prove to us that you can hold your own in high A, double A, triple A, you're going to be playing in Anaheim very soon.
And the Angels, who, you know, Jordan and I have been very vocal, we think they're bad.
Yes.
They are currently one game below 500. They have won three in a row. They've won seven of their last 10. They're 2.5 back of a wild card spot. It's as close as they've been this deep into the season in the post-Otani era. And bringing up Christian Moore is a fun, aggressive play. He was one of the best college baseball players of the 21st century. Last year, he won the College World Series at Tennessee. He is a Brooklyn kid, like, from Brooklyn. And there are not many ball players who make it to the big leagues from New York City. I think that's super cool. He hit a baseball last year, Russ, in Omaha for the cycle. That was one of the most jaw-dropping batted balls I've seen in a long time. Just a dead center laser beam out at in Omaha, which is an enormous park. He's immensely physical. He impacts the baseball. The question is, what does the whiff look like? What does the chase look like? Can he be an above-average defender at second base? If he does, this guy could be like a borderline all-star level player who brings his fair share of highlight reel plays on the offensive side. I'm going to move to bad, and I'm going to talk about Hunter Dobbins. This whole Hunter Dobbins scenario is so bizarre and so messy and so weird. And I think in the end, it is not just bad, it is sad. Hunter Dobbins, pitcher for the Boston Red Sox, made some headlines last week when he said he'd rather retire than play for the Yankees. Everyone, upon hearing that, said, that's not true. Like, if you are presented with the situation, one day you will not retire, you will play for the Yankees, but that's cute. When saying that, part of his distaste for the Bombers stemmed from his dad, who he told media was drafted twice by them and traded to the Diamondbacks, and he held that grudge for a long time. And then, friend of the program, Joel Sherman of the New York Post, drops the hammer on this liar, Hunter Dobbins, and reveals that Hunter Dobbins, Mr. Dobbins' dad, I believe Lance Dobbins, never played affiliated minor league baseball, never drafted by the Diamondbacks, never drafted by the Yankees, never played with Andy Pettit, like this Dobbins said. And it was like the back page in New York. It was like, I think it was like Wicked Whopper was the headline. It was like, oh, Hunter Dobbins is lying. And now Hunter Dobbins has to speak about it. And this is a quote from Hunter Dobbins. The whole backstory stuff that I heard growing up, seen pictures from my dad. At the end of the day, it's just from my dad. And what kind of grew my love for the game. At the end of the day, I don't go and fact check my dad or anything like that. What we have here appears to be a father lying to his son.
Oh, no.
What?
Jeez, man. One, shout out to Joel. The more I've gotten to know Joel over the years, the more I like Joel. Like, Joel is great. But the fact that after all of this, like, I was down for the I'll retire thing. Like, most people know, if you're a ball knower, Ken Griffey Jr., his dad had some beef with the Yankees going back when, you know, he couldn't be on the field with, you know, his dad, even though Greg Nettles' son and his or and him were out on the field during BP. And I was like, cool. But the fact that it's not true, on top of all of this, you just gave Yankees fans so much smoke and fire and media, etc. Like, no, you don't. I agree with him. You don't fact check your dad. But it's one of those things, like, once you get to this point in your career where, like, people will fact check you, especially when you get to the big leagues, like, you can't just throw that story out there not having the evidence.
And it's not that hard. If you go to a good baseball website called Baseball awesome. Reference and you type in Dobbins, okay, you type in Dobbins, you'll find Lance Dobbins, his dad, and you click on Lance Dobbins' page, and he played 2 years of indie ball, all right, with a career 8.64 ERA. But his biggest crime was not pitching poorly. It was lying to your son.
Listen, man, you made your dad, like, I think the worst part for me is you made your dad look bad. When, who doesn't love a good story? And sometimes dads are going to tell a good story. Doesn't have to be the most accurate or factual. But yeah, now your dad's like, ah, yeah, sorry, son. I lied because it was a good story and it made you fall in love with the game.
And now you got to wear it right. in public. That's tough. What's bad right, for what's you? What's bad for did anybody lie
nobody,
to you?
Well, it tends to happen, you know, when you work in baseball. People lie. But what's bad for me okay. this week, Kodai Senga going down with a hamstring strain, landing on the IL, and just the all-around just awkward play, ground ball to first base to Pete Alonso. Pete gets the ball over, tosses it high. Senga has to go up and get it. And immediately comes down and it grabs him. He's writhing in pain on the first baseline. Pete obviously feels terrible. And he said after the game that Senga told him that he felt it before he ever went up to get the ball. So it wasn't your fault. But this sucks because Kodai Senga having an amazing year for the New York Mets, who starting pitching has been phenomenal for them. That's the one saving grace about the Mets this season. Starter ERA, 2.79 for the New York Mets. And I wrote about this last week, like what their pitching infrastructure, Jeremy Hefner and those guys have done in Queens, taking guys like Griffin Canning, David Peterson, who had an awesome start this week, and turning those guys into not only serviceable big league arms in a rotation, but dominant as of late. Big, like Griffin Canning shut down the Dodgers out in LA at Dodger Stadium. David Peterson, complete game shutout this week. Like, they have been able to turn their rotation into a stable of horses. But it's unfortunate that the best pitcher for them, once again, has another soft tissue injury. You know, he wasn't able to pitch at the end of the last season after the calf injury. So the soft tissue injuries for Kodai Senga over the last 2 years, not great.
Get some hard tissues. The Mets will be okay. Like, they'll find guys to eat those innings. They've done it all year. But Senga is, in my opinion, the most electrifying. The split is just super fun to watch. So it is a bummer that he's headed to the IL. Ugly time. The College World Series, Men's College World Series, starts today in Omaha. I will be out there on Sunday for a couple of days. And one of the funner, not a word, one of the more enjoyable things about Omaha in recent years has been the Jello Shot Board, which takes place over at Rocco's, a bar catty corner to Charles Schwab Field in downtown Omaha. It is a contest where whichever fan base buys the most Jello shots wins. What do they win? Pride. And there is a leaderboard up in the bar. I wrote a long feature about it last year, kind of like the origin of the Jello Shot contest and the mechanisms behind it. How do they get the Jello Shots? Who's paying for all these? I mean, we're talking like tens of thousands of Jello Shots, like hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on Jello Shots. And just to preview this year's contest, we're already off to a compelling start, which is LSU, who set the all-time record for Jello Shot consumption 2 years ago in 2023 during the Paul Skeens era, is in the early lead before games have begun. However, Murray State, the Cinderella, is going to be on their heels all tournament long. LSU is at 525 Jello Shots, which go for $5 a pop as of last night. Murray State at 385 in second place. And that's because every neutral person is going to be throwing Murray State up on that board. And so hopefully we get an LSU versus Murray State jello shot showdown over the next couple of weeks. That is my ugly.
Jello shot. You talk about 2 years ago when LSU set the record. That was also the same year that my Oral Roberts University Golden Eagles made it to the College World Series. What a run for that team. Have you had a pleasure of having one of those jello shots?
Yeah, I've had a couple. Myself and friend of the program, Clinton Yates, indulged in a jello shot or two a couple years ago. They're not for me.
Okay.
From a taste perspective, I understand the bit. It is a great environment and a lot of the money goes to charity.
Love that.
And so I'm for it as an idea, but you will not catch me. They're not terrible. Like, they're not inedible.
Okay.
But they're not tasty.
That's what I was wanted to get at, because like, you see the numbers, like I love watching the numbers climb as the College World Series goes on, and you're like, wow, they've sold 7,500 jello shots. Like, that's crazy. But it's like, are these shots that great? Like, is that why they're selling? But it's like, okay, it's part of the bit. You want to win for the pride. I understand it. And I like that the money goes to charity. I like that.
Yeah. A couple of years, it was like a, it was a thing for boosters to show off. Like, that's what this was about. It was like LSU boosters wanting to be first in the list. And they created a rule that the jello shots have to be consumed on campus, like on premises. You can't take them away. So like, you can't just buy the, like, they have to be, they have to exist. You can't just be like, here's the money, put us on the board. Like, you the jello shots have to exist. What's your ugla, Russ?
My ugla, Jake Mintz, you are one of the smartest baseball people that I know. And you're usually up on all the latest baseball happenings, you know, big leagues, college, minor leagues. You and Jordan are great. Do you know who the best hitter in the world outside of Cal Raleigh and Aaron Judge over the last month has been?
I believe, based upon your phrasing, that it is a player from another country's league. And based upon your phrasing, I'm going to guess that it is an American or Latin player playing in either Korea or Japan. And I'm going to guess either Tyler Austin or Jake Cave.
I see, that's exactly why I set this up the way I did, because I just wanted to show people that that's how much you know baseball, that you could just pull Jake Cave, Tyler Austin out of thin air and say, well, these guys are playing abroad and we're tearing it up. This is who you thought. No, it's actually not that deep. The best hitter in baseball over the last month, not named Cal Raleigh or Aaron Judge, has been Max Muncy, Jake Mintz. Can you believe that? Max Muncy, who has an OPS of 1.062 wow, over the last month with 7 pumps. And that's not the most interesting part about Max Muncy setting the world on fire. He's been known to be a streaky hitter during his career, especially since he's gotten to LA with the Dodgers. Like, he's one of the best left-handed bats in baseball when he's on. But May 2nd, Jake Mintz, Max Muncy decided, you know, the old eyesight hasn't been great. I'm going to throw on glasses for the first time in his career. And he's been an absolute monster since he started wearing glasses. And I was out in LA about 2 weeks ago, the day he hits a couple of homers against the Yankees when they throttled the Yankees 18-2. And he was asked about it. And he said, look, man, I can't pretend that they haven't helped. Oh, they've done more than help, Jake. Like, they've turned this guy into Barry Bonds over the last 30 days. And I think that's pretty dope.
So I saw the Dodgers in Miami the week after he got the glasses. And the whole narrative at that time was, all right, Max Muncy having a rough start, getting glasses, maybe this will help. And the week after he got the glasses, he was still terrible.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, it was hard to write that story at that point, but it clearly seems to have turned around and it clearly seems to have helped him. Good for Max Muncy. Because, I mean, there was a point during the season, it was like, is this a viable guy to start every day at third base? Now, obviously, yes. Curious what it means for him moving forward on this team. I believe he's one more year left on his extension. Do they trade him? Do they go get another third baseman? Are they going to commit to him long term? Probably not. He's a little older. I do love, Russ, that you set that up for me, and my brain just was so far off the right track. Like, it was,
you were so like, oh, saying the Jake way that Cave, you said it. I like, saw you, Jake,
you gave me a good
it.
Prompt.
Most people probably think Jake Cave's still playing in the big leagues. Like, that tells you how locked in you are, bro.
Yeah, Jake Cave was on the Rockies last year, and you can make a point that that's not necessarily big league baseball. All right, Russ Dorsey, thank you for joining me. Before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to say, you'd like to plug, you'd like to announce here on this beautiful show?
No, man. I appreciate you having me, as always. This is fun. I miss talking ball with you guys, so this is great.
Jake Cave is slashing .279, .323, .383 for the Doosan Bears. I think that not enough slug. I think we want to see more slug out of Jake Cave over there in the KBO, but he is hitting .279. So, you know, maybe not quite all-star level, but Jake Cave, hope you're doing great. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Russ Dorsey, for stepping in and pinch hitting for Jordan. Thank you to TJ Brasu and Andrew Hartz for producing. Thank you to myself for just being on it today. I'm currently out in Tahoe for a wedding for a buddy of mine with all of my college baseball teammates, Russ. And we were sitting around last night. There was like seven of us just watching the 2005 NLDS Astros Braves because we had Chris Burke on this week. So I put on it's all on YouTube in full. And I put on the full game. We just sat around, had some beers, and watched a 20-year-old baseball game. Nirvana. Like, that's what it's all about.
I love that.
You know? And so that really invigorated me this morning, that me and the boys, it was a true dude's rock moment, you know, sitting in the Airbnb watching a baseball game for 20 years ago. And one of my teammates had a really good idea that I want to run by you before we say goodbye. The K-Zone box should be able to be flipped on and off with a remote on MLB TV.
I don't hate that idea. Like, I think it's one of the things, as we've gotten more technologically savvy and these networks have tried to innovate the broadcast more, sometimes it can be too much where it's just like, hey, I just want to see, like, I'll know what's a strike and what's a ball because I know what a strike zone looks like. But yeah, I think that's subtle enough.
Let me
to where you could do that. I don't know how it would work across the board. Like, will your RSNs be able to do something like that? Or is it just the national broadcast? But people throw out a lot of suggestions for games these days. I like that idea more than most.
It's a good idea. It's a good idea. So shout out to my college teammate for opening up Pandora's brain. Thank you all for listening. I'm going to go take a nap. Bye.